Hey, GPR crew, this is Chris from the GunnaGeek.com show, Starling Tribune, All Things Good Nerdy, and a bunch of other stuff. Just saw you guys are hitting episode 200. Wanted to send in a hearty congratulations on that accomplishment. 200 is a ridiculous number for a podcast, so congrats to you guys for hitting that number. And hey, the positive thing is, the way they keep churning out more and more seasons of Doctor Who, you guys are likely to be here for another 200 more, so keep up the great work. I can't think of a better podcast to be the official Doctor Who podcast on the Gunna Geek Network. Once again, congrats, and here's to another 200. Bye, guys.
This is Paul McGann, the Eighth Doctor. You're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Go and throw yourself under a bus. I didn't mean to say that. He told me to say that.
Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten. Did you just say womp womp? And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I like it with the helmet on.
And Keir Hansen.
And that's why, to this day, I can't eat cotton candy.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 201 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we realize to our own horror that if we drift too far into the land of fiction, we risk becoming fictional characters ourselves, two-dimensional images of our previous selves. Not so bad if you're trying to squeeze into a crowded convention elevator, I guess, but pants are going to fit weird, for sure. Oh, and under no circumstances should you let anyone else try and recall your face from memory. They're going to seriously let you down, and results are distressing, to say the least. I'm your host, Haley Malley, and with me today in the GPR studios, we have the one, the only, Keir Hansen. How are you today, Keir?
I'm all alone, all by myself.
What am I, chopped liver?
me, personally, alone. Okay. Here. No one else wants to hang out with me on debate night. But before we even get cracking on this one, just to let everybody know, this week we're spinning back to what, in many, many Whovians' eyes is considered to be one of the most iconic stories of the classic era, and that's the Second Doctor in The Mind Robber. Now, Troughton being paired off with Jamie and Zoe, it incorporates elements of science fiction and classic literature. There are plays on words and statements about the significance of creativity and creative writing, and more than a few historical anecdotes about, well, shiny cat suits, kilts being loaned out, and mules being painted. I mean, unicorns. Yeah, that was totally, totally a unicorn, kids. Eloop, 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 eloop. Plausible. this, in general, you know, I know we kind of raved about some of the other Troughton stories because the ones that we have are just so thoroughly enjoyable. I think it's kind of been established that GPR is very much a pro Troughton camp here in general. But Haley, this is your first time through these stories.
Yes.
What was your take on the, or I should say through these episodes, what was your take on the story in general?
It was a lot of fun. The only thing that could have made it perfect were some Lilliputians, but, you know, what are you going to do?
How can you have Gulliver without Lilliputians? Well, there's a lot of really interesting backstory to everything that went into this production, and it answers a lot of the questions that I know first viewers that I've watched go through it, and you can let me know and chime in on this if this is something you experience as well. When you notice things like when you see the episodes laid out, and you're queuing them up, if it's from the DVD set or if you got them digitally or what have you, you're looking at them and you're like, okay, this is five episodes, got it, all right, so total running time, wait a minute, total running time, and you do the math on it, and you look at the individual episodes, you're like, what, 18, 19 minutes?
Yeah, which is good going into preparation for this podcast.
It's, yeah, I guess it covers itself nicely. But there's a great story behind it, and it really has a lot to do with the fact that the state of where the BBC was at the time. So, all right, your writer, Peter Ling, this was actually his first attempt at writing science fiction. Mm-hmm. We have spoken with both Derek Sherwin, who was the principal script editor for this one, and we've actually also spoken here on GPR with Terrence Dix, who is this was one of his first forays as an assistant script editor on this one. So they had an opportunity to be able to reach out to additional writers. They were sort of treating this point in the season or in the series as an opportunity to farm out new writers. And they reached out to Peter Ling, but he had never written science fiction before. He had written things that had a lot of literary bases. And they said, perfect. That's great. Let's go at it and kind of pretend that this is a, you know, a children's lit adventure that happens to involve the Doctor. And I think that's really what you kind of get out of this thing. But they had just come off of the previous story that I guess either – I don't know if the story was that it ran over budget or that it felt a little long. That was the Dominators that you guys had watched. But I guess they were stuck at a point where they couldn't in order to fill the scheduling gap, it had to run five episodes, and Ling had only written a four-episode story.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. Well, here's a funny thing. They ended up actually writing the first episode as the addendum, which worked out, you know, with just the three of them. If you sit there, you watch through it, and you say, you know, whatever, 19, maybe 20 minutes for that one. And you're like, wait a minute. There's nobody else in this episode. It's just the TARDIS team.
Right. And basically that whole episode is don't leave the TARDIS.
Right. But I think I have to give them credit. It's still entertaining.
Yeah. I don't think it's, like, the slowest episode of Doctor Who I've watched to this point, even.
Mm. I didn't get to a point where I don't really feel with any of these things that any of the scenes ran particularly long. Mm-mm. If you ask Wendy Padbury, she says the fight scene with Carcass was a little long. She wanted that to just be a... she just wanted to be a couple of tumbles and get the heck out of there. Because they had to do it in a single take. It wasn't something where they could just shoot and edit and whatnot. But I guess they were only budgeted... Or wherever they were within the series here, they had zero money to add this fifth episode. So they had to do it absolutely with just existing set. They had a white cyclorama that they were able to utilize. They grabbed some robots that they had from some other sci-fi drama thing that they had going on. So they found them all archived. They painted them white. Painting white becomes a theme in this story, apparently. and they shot this entire thing. But I guess... the reason why all the episodes ended up short is because Troughton went back to the BBC and said, well, there's only three of us carrying this entire episode. We want to see commensurate pay. And they said, well, there's no budget for it. And he said, figure it out. So they ended up having to, like, trim length on all the other episodes so that they would be able to make sure that everybody was getting adequate pay for their invested time and efforts. This is just this bizarre story, but I totally understand that because the three of them were that whole first episode. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I look now looking at it. There's a great little documentary piece that goes along with the DVD release. If you get the opportunity to be able to see it, it runs maybe about, you know, half hour longer than any episode in the story, but it's really interesting stuff because you get interviews not only with Derek Sherwin, you get interviews with Peter Ling as a writer, with David Maloney, and this is actually one of his first directorial jobs. So he was coming into this and having not, you know, put a lot of notches in his belt in doing these sort of things. The decisions he was making, though, as far as you see a lot of close-up shots and a lot of things like, you know, with somebody in the foreground out of focus where you're actually focused on somebody in the middle distance and all these interesting kind of visual aspects that that Maloney brought to the table that I think made for a really interesting visual experience to go along with, I thought, a really good story from Ling. I loved, like, Gulliver and those things, and having, you know, the fact that he was pulling all of his dialogue from something that would have been drawn directly from his source text. I thought that was a really cool aspect. Did you place where the kids were from?
Were they, like, I don't know. Well, I mean, I got kind of a Wizard of Oz feel from especially the last part.
Yeah. I guess. Yeah, I was more Alice in Wonderland, Alice Through the Looking Glass.
Yeah.
Because this was all, you know, the power of words.
Really just the introduction of the Master of Fiction. That was the Wizard of Ozzy part.
Mm. Yeah, definitely get that.
The children, I don't know. There's just various fictional children, I guess. I can't think of a specific one that they reminded me of.
Or maybe it's just general nursery rhymes, because it was all about riddles and they were singing Ring Around the Rosie and things like that. So maybe it was just sort of that you know, the archetypal, you know, kids rhyme stuff. But as far as like just the what you get from your principal cast, you know, Troughton, obviously, as a doctor, this one has one of the best foreshadowing lines of any story, where, you know, things are doing whatever they're doing in the first episode, and Zoe comes to him. She's all concerned. The doctor looks really out of sorts, and she says, "You know, you don't look right." You know, I'm paraphrasing here, and he says, "The only thing that worries me is the unknown." Well, gosh, if you don't know what you're about to be exposed to, let's find out what worries the doctor and give him 5 episodes of that. You know, as far as like your overall core, you know, Second Doctor firing away with Jamie McCrimmon and Zoe, how did that strike you as far as all of their chemistry and their interaction throughout the story?
It matches spot on with the, you know, what we've seen up to this. Well, what little I've seen of the three of them together up to this point. There was a part where at the very beginning of this, where the doctor's like, "I don't know what's out there, so we can't go out there," which is very much unlike anything a modern doctor would say, because a lot of the modern doctors are like, "I don't know what's out there. Let's go look." And this Troughton's doctor just seems in general much more responsible and adult-like than a lot of other doctors I've ever seen.
I get a lot of that paternal aspect from him, particularly oriented towards Jamie and Zoe, because the two of them are prone to drawing disaster about them.
Well, you know, he told them to stay in the TARDIS. Where were they? Not in the TARDIS.
Yeah. Zoe was very much the catalyst through a lot of this. You know, her wandering out of the TARDIS, her emphatically insinuating that she had to look at Medusa. You know, she couldn't. I'm like, well, it's really, your eyes are already closed. Just keep them closed. You know, what's tearing at you so much? I can understand when the hands were on her face, that sort of thing.
But just by the way,
I was doing a bit of live tweeting on this one. So if anybody was chiming in on that one, I'm sorry for subjecting you to this. Well, I'm not really sorry. To me, Medusa is the prototype for the Weeping Angels.
I thought the same
way
thing.
They were portraying her. Yeah. Yeah.
Are they cousins or something?
Yeah, it's got to be. Well, we also have... there's obviously... You can't discuss this particular story without talking about the Jamie flip, which...
The doctor's always
viewing,
had a hard time with faces.
Yeah. I was so good until I got to the mouth. I love the fact that in both iterations of putting Jamie's face back together, he goes, "Well, that's his nose. Can't get the nose wrong."
Good thing Zoe was there the second time.
To poke him in the arm, that mouth. But did you have any idea what was happening in the story, like going into this? Did you know any of the backstory about why, or about what was going to happen and why?
Of course, I didn't. I didn't know anything about this.
Okay. So how did that end up striking you? As far as, you know, all of a sudden they've got Hamish popping in there.
I guess I didn't really think about it because it was just, you know, part of an episode and I was watching one right before it and right after it. So I didn't take a lot of time to think about why they would throw another actor in there, but I'm sure you're going to tell me.
Well, that's the cool story about it. I mean, so I guess Fraser Hines, they are absolutely locked, or were absolutely locked to a production schedule because of transmission times. You had to have each episode ready to go for the following week to be put out there, even if it was only 19 minutes. So apparently Fraser had developed chickenpox, and they had to scramble that week to get somebody in. So they called in Hamish Wilson, and he had to be ready like by the next day to start shooting. And it wasn't like they had time to like prep costumes, but he was wearing Fraser's kilt. Yeah.
So Fraser's that's how they shirt. Picked him. He wore the same size clothes.
He fit. Although he's a true Scot. He's like a Glasgow Scot.
Well,
which is
with
why
the name like Hamish.
Yeah, just a little bit. Although having nothing to do with the Hunger Games this time around. But I think he did a commendable job of mimicking Fraser.
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah. You know, stuck with some sort of weird face that he kept pawing at every once in a while. Don't wonder why it felt weird. But yeah, I thought that was a great aspect. So, and obviously they already had the script written, so they had to do a little revision to put in the face puzzle game, and then get him back out of it. Obviously, when Fraser was better for the subsequent episodes. So, but you know, in retrospect, looking back at that, that was pretty seamless.
That was brilliant. And if it went on more than a week, they just put the reversion face puzzle later in a different episode. You know.
Yeah, I think they should revisit this more often. And got substitutes in there.
I really want to see Capaldi trying to do a face puzzle and just completely baffled.
Remember what his companion looks like. No, she's got the big eyes. She does the thing.
He sees the whole face and he doesn't recognize it. Imagine him trying to figure out parts of a face.
I love it. That'd be the best game to play with the 12th Doctor is draw your companion. Although the funny thing is, in actuality, we've seen that Capaldi is really good at doing caricatures. Like, really, really good. You know, he did that whole thing for the Doctor Who fan show where he sat there and did these sketches of all the predecessor doctors from memory, and he was nailing them one after another. Talk about having to suspend disbelief. Well, anyway, but then we get to another one of the great stories or anecdotes that comes out of this, which has to do with Zoe and all the things that she gets subjected to through the course of this story, from her wardrobe to her fight scenes,
Her
wardrobe in her... Yeah. She's always been really good-natured about it. And obviously, we've seen from a couple of interviews we've had with both her and Fraser that they attack each other lovingly, incessantly.
Yeah.
They are the best frenemies.
Brother and sister.
It's horrible. If you didn't know they loved each other so much, you'd think they were trying to poison one another. But it's the anecdotes that came out of this, like her on the TARDIS console spinning around with her butt to the camera, the fight scenes with Carcass where she's just flipping him over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, and finally puts him in a sleeper hold. It was great. I was waiting for, you know, for Troughton to come like jumping down as the ref. Yeah, 1, 2, 3, you're out. But I thought she was absolutely on point in this story. Everything about it, from the screams when she's trapped in the jar to everything. She was just this was Wendy's crown jewel episodes.
When the doctor throws her across the threshold.
I don't know, just so much about it. I think this was when she had some of the best dialogue as far as her opportunity to be able to be, like we were saying earlier, she's kind of the catalyst for a lot of the problems, so she's setting things in motion, but she's intrinsically involved with the solution set. She's both attacking things from an intellectual and clearly physical standpoint when necessary, you know, applying her mathematical reasoning to getting them out of the maze in a labyrinth. I mean, just point after point after point. I think Peter Ling did an excellent job of creating a very, yeah, I'm about to say, a three-dimensional character in a two-dimensional story. I thought it was so appropriate that they got smashed inside French literature, though. Ugh, that stuff's so dense. It'll crush anyone.
No, they should have had a Russian novel up there.
Yeah, just Chekhov. Oh, God, no. Now, what about as far as dealing with, especially from your perspective, coming in at this the first time, all of this mention of referring to your villain as the Master?
I forgot that I had seen the first appearance of the Master in a Third Doctor episode, okay. And I was thinking this was it. This was his first appearance until, you know, the very end.
Okay. I just wanted to see how that played because that was a very... you know, if you're doing this in reverse chronology, I can see that being a huge problem. Mm-hmm. They never actually give the character a name, a credited name, other than the Master of the Land or the Master Writer in some instances or things like that. Yeah. So it's not particularly helpful in distinguishing. But I like the guy. I like the fact that he was so completely under the Master Brain's control that when they finally were able to blow the computer and break him loose of it, he snapped right back to, you know, he's Rip Van Winkle coming out of the dream, you know. So, but I'm so glad that they fixed his makeup. from, what was it, episode 3 to episode 4, they had something going on where they were trying to age him. They were trying to make him look really stark, and they had like all these lines down his nose and across his cheekbones, these dark lines to try and make him look far more, you know, what have you. But for some reason, they ended up with this white blob at the corner of his mouth through the whole thing. And I'm staring at him like I can't. It's like the mole in Austin Powers. Moly, 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 moly. Yeah. But then you go right into episode 4 and his makeup is completely softened. It's like just base pancake. The little thing is gone. Oh, my God. Thank you so much for fixing that. It was driving me nuts.
It would have been funny if they were like, yeah, we saw the problem. We knew how to fix it, but we left it for continuity.
Okay, we had already done it for like 5 scenes out of the entire. We couldn't change it. Continuity is, yeah.
You know how that important that is to us.
Clearly. I'm going to throw one last weird thing at you.
Okay.
So you had, when you were meeting Gulliver, the funny thing is that we find out, and I'm going to spoil this a little bit for you, is that, well, because because our listeners are going to know.
Because the episode you're probably talking about is only 40 years old.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think it's outside the statute of limitations here. So you're dealing actually with a Time Lord masquerading as Gulliver.
Okay.
Because it was actually the CIA, the Celestial Intervention Agency, who sent Goth. I am never in my life going to be able to pronounce Time Lord Goth's full name properly. I can't do it. It's Goth Pardiscaraladripakalath. I can't. It's Goth. So Time Lord Goth. And you end up seeing him again in the War Games, if you remember that one. Remember when they were gathering all the doctors together into the mist, or they're gathering the doctor into the mist with all the soldiers from different eras. You didn't get to that one.
No.
We'll get you to that one.
Okay.
And then again in The Deadly Assassin. So you'll get a chance with him with Tom Baker. So Goth was actually sort of a monitor for the Doctor on behalf of the Time Lords, specifically on behalf of the Celestial Intervention Agency, to sort of make sure that that he was adhering to the laws of time and all the Time Lord tenets. And it was because his inability to do so over the course of the Second Doctor's tenure that he ends up getting exiled to Earth during the Third Doctor's era. You know, they basically disable his TARDIS and stick him on Earth and say, you know, you're in timeout, literally. So that's Goth will be a character that comes back in some points in televised and quite a bit in the novels as well. But anyway, but I thought as Gulliver, I loved him. I thought he was awesome. You know, big, formidable guy, great language, really committed to his character, and he was totally character neutral. He didn't help them unless it made sense to. He didn't harm them unless it made sense to. He was just going with whatever the situation demanded at any given moment, because he was just this, you know, this NPC within the game, basically. I loved it.
Yeah, I liked him a lot. The way he was doing his voice, it kept making me think of Christopher Lee.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll pick up on that. It's funny, when you mentioned voices, Carcass and his bizarre German delivery.
I couldn't notice his voice around his muscle costume.
Apparently he was a pretty jacked guy.
Yeah.
But they went and put this rubber suit on him, and he was horribly uncomfortable in the thing. So they basically poured a half a gallon of talcum powder down his collar to help. And then they made him fight. So he was just swimming in all of this liquid clay inside the rubber suit. I can't imagine how uncomfortable it was for this poor guy. But he, he was a... You hear him speak in documentaries and stuff, and he has a very kind of... not soft-spoken, but very erudite, very, very clear, distinct speaking voice. Very British. And then you go and you hear carcass come cracking out with this, you know, I will disintegrate you. I will turn you into mincemeats and so forth. So, you know, and I guess Christopher Robbie said, I have no idea where that voice came from. The actor who played Gargus, he's like, but I realized really quickly as we started, you know, doing rehearsals and I had lines to deliver through these fight sequences that my voice wouldn't match this comic book character from the year 2000, by the way. Those fond memories of the telestrips in 2000, our comic book heroes with their disintegrator ray guns. Boy, I'm glad they were wrong about what...
The only other thing I have is at the end when the doctor and not the master were doing their like
the not dueling, master
the not master yeah they're doing their dueling storyteller thing where one of them says something and then
so D'Artagnan versus Cyrano no versus Lancelot no versus
there was an episode of Xena where there was a magic scroll, and whatever you wrote down happened. Whatever you wrote down literally happened. And then there's a big battle at the end where the scroll keeps getting knocked into different people's hands, and it was almost exactly like that. Like, just people coming out of nowhere.
Yeah. I think The X-Files did that one, too. Supernatural has done one, obviously. They did the whole writer episodes where there was a guy writing for the Winchester brothers, and anything that he wrote, you know, he was the prophet. This has become a trope at this point, but this may not have been the first. I'll challenge the listeners to see if they can come up with any other literary reference where there was the writer writing, where you had someone writing for the affected characters in real time. I'd love to see how far back this goes. So I challenge you all with the rabbit hole. Go dive. Just all in all, this is just a fun one-off story.
Yeah.
And I think it set precedent for subsequent stories that we'll get not for a while. They took a pretty long hiatus from, you know, they ended up diving really back into format after this for quite some time. But I think now, more so in New Who than in Classic Who, I think they've had more of an opportunity to be able to say, you know what, let's go into something completely off the grid. Off the space-time grid, really. Put us in nowhere and let them run around with an adventure that has no impact on anything but their own safety.
Yeah. Well, the format of production at the time probably made it more difficult to do something completely different like this. Just because, you know, if you're doing something completely different and you end up behind schedule or over budget or something like that, the format at the time was much less forgiving to that.
Well, look at all the sets, too. I mean, we were talking about budget at the beginning of this thing and the fact that they must have had a very specific allocation. They were doing all kinds of things, like the castle ramparts and all of these other, you know, all these other settings and things that they must have figured out how to do. I can't imagine what a shoestring budget they had for getting some of these things done. And for all the flack that people look back on Classic Who and say, God, the sets that moved, cave
because
floors
it was
that
built
had...
in 2 hours out of styrofoam. Of course it moves.
Precisely, yeah. It had like kind of a repertory theater set kind of feel to it. You know, they put it together and it's representational. Like things like the Forest of Words. Holy crap. You know, when you get that reveal of the fact that all these weird little structures they've been wandering around in for 25 minutes... And then not Jamie ends up climbing up to the top and goes, I'm standing on a giant S. And, you know, and they get that whole thing. That's a great concept.
Yeah.
You know, and I think they did a fair job of saying, well, if you're in the crook of an S and you have to crawl up, yeah, that's kind of what it's going to look like. I get it. So, you know, kudos to them for it. I think it's funny, though. These are the things that I take away from it. This is what I think about late at night when the lights are off. The white TARDIS. I want a white TARDIS. There's that one moment in the first episode, right before the, you know, TARDIS explodes, where you see one that is done entirely in white. I think that looks so freaking cool. I want that for a Christmas ornament. So anybody out there who's crafty, I'll pay you cash money, like Canadian dollars, not even fake U.S. dollars, real Canadian plastic money for making me a white TARDIS. Well, all that being said, because we are we got a couple of other things on our agenda for this evening, and we'll be getting the news in just a moment. But hey, for those of us here stateside, it's first debate night, so we're going to make sure that we get over to that to watch the fireworks. But it's also Haley's birthday, so happy Ooh. Birthday to you, kid!
Thank you.
And I insisted that she drink through this cast, so. You know, if she gets up every once in a while to go refill a glass, that's her. Wow. What the hell is that? Is that a fireball?
Yeah.
Damn. Not even ice to cut that. Nothing.
No.
Wow.
That's how I do.
Do we have the Cheez-Its nearby to help give that a solid bed?
I ate pizza before I started drinking.
There you go. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Drinking responsibly. Pizza and straight fireball. A half gallon
Hi, Mom.
Of it. Hi, Ma. Just listener number four. There you are. All right. Well, shall we get into our newsifications?
Yep, let's get to it.
All right. All right, two things that are just kind of funsies, and then one aspect that we're going to put in here because it's pretty close to the most important thing that we could possibly talk about this week. Just for fun, we did note that there was another. I think we had mentioned last week that we had some intrepid Whovians who did a little digging. They did some theorizing about putting together plot holes and patching things up. We've got another Whovian brilliant mind. Who caught the fact that we have had two actor crossovers between franchises that follow an eerie pattern. So we have a connection between the classic Minotaur, interesting that we were talking about, the Labyrinth and the Minotaur for this story. Not the same one, though. But we have the Minotaur who played... Or the actor who played the Minotaur in the 72 episode, The Time Monster, who also ended up playing the physical Darth Vader before the James Earl Jones overdubs. So David Prowse, big 6'5" guy, formidable, so he's got the stature. So he ended up becoming a lot of... he played these representational characters. They used him in Doctor Who to be this giant, hulking bull beast. And then he was the physical manifestation of Vader, or the original voice of Vader, before James Earl Jones was brought in to say, well, we want something deeper and more resonant. Well, fast forward to the New Who 11th Doctor story... The God Complex, okay, with a weird hotel and everyone finding all their, you know, their nightmares and things. And you've got that scene where young Amelia Pond is sitting there, the Doctor, Amy and Rory come busting in, and they see her, and you've got this other Minotaur appearance. Well, come to find out, that actor who was in that suit was Spencer Wilding, who is, well, at this point, rumored. I don't think he's been confirmed, but he's going to be in the Vader suit for Rogue One.
Interesting. They're really limiting their casting options if you have to have played a Minotaur in Doctor Who to get the role.
Do you wear a costume that is both constricting, disconcerting, and involves heavy headgear? Okay. You've met our criteria. Put the helmet on. But yeah, that's a strange coincidence. That's a really strange coincidence. I mean, I understand that some of these actors, when they're playing representational characters or heavily costumed actors, that you've got a very specific go-to set. You know, you look at Chewbacca, look at Classic Who. They had the guys that were wearing the various monster suits. It was usually about the same team of 4 to 6 people who are in those suits week in, week out. Oh, I'm putting a rubber thing on? Okay. I'm putting a robot thing on? Oh, okay. I'm putting a fur thing on? Okay, you got it. So that's what becomes your curriculum vitae. So I guess this is similar, but man, what a jump to go from the 70s to the what do we call this here? We're not the noughts anymore. We're in the teens. Teens. That sounds so stupid. And have the same crossover from exactly one franchise to the other in exactly the same character. That's, what are the odds? Never tell me the odds. That's I put my little button on that one. There you go. All right. Next item. This caught my attention. It actually just released today as we were recording. Because I'm here and I'm recording here from Connecticut, so I got Yale just a couple of dozen of miles away here. They conducted one of their surveys, but they decided rather than to survey here people here in the States, that's Quinnipiac's job, is to survey Brits, and they asked them their favorite home as depicted on television, their favorite fictional home. So they could have had anything to choose from, all their dramatic series. You know, think Downton Abbey. How could you go wrong? But no. What did they choose?
The TARDIS, obviously.
The perfect home.
It makes whatever room you want.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know. I'm going to challenge. I know we have at least two listeners who are real estate agents. I want to know if you're putting together the listing write-up for the TARDIS. You know, it's not a fixer-upper. Well, at times it's a fixer-upper opportunity.
Square foot, infinite.
Square footage. It's just the infinite symbol. Yeah. You know, requires a little bit of TLC. Some elbow grease required. May need electrical improvements.
Yeah, but it's got a pool and a library.
Has a distinct personality. So please let our realtors out there get back to us on some potential write-ups. I might have to put a blog together on this because this is too good. Yeah, so there you go. According to Brits, it is their favorite home. And we'll link to the article. It's kind of fun. But let's get to the news that matters. Facebook Live in all of their new thing that they're doing. They got the cast of Class together to do a little segment just the other day. Dropped some information on us. Proceeded to make us both extremely happy. And here in the United States, made us extremely confused.
So, good news first. We finally have a premiere date for Class. Yay!
Yeah! Well, Who's we?
The royal we, which is not us American plebes.
Cursed plebes. Yeah. October 22nd.
Yeah.
And here's a weird thing. Not only are you getting the first episode, you're getting the first two. Ooh. Yeah. Technically, the release date for the first two episodes are the 22nd. So you're going to be able to like dive full on into this thing. But I don't... But here's what's the flip side of the coin, Haley? I mean, this is the kicker.
American listeners, good news for you. You get to savor your anticipation and watch it sometime in the spring. I don't know. Did they give a specific date?
They said it's going to be paired in conjunction with the release of Series 10 of Doctor Who, which
right.
The thing that's killing me is that, well, at the same time as we were told that Class was going to be the bridge to bring us in, to carry us through the wilderness year, so there wasn't really a wilderness year. Well, here in the States, yeah, it is a year. But the kicker is that this production, Class itself, is partnered with BBC America. It's partially their production, their isolated budget behind it. So some of Merkin money... is going behind putting this together, and we've got to wait. I tweeted this because it has actually happened. We have just been Sherlocked. it boggles me.
That's okay. We're tapping into the podcast travel budget so we can fly to the UK and watch it every week, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, no. We've reached a special dispensation, but we'll deal with that after the 22nd. But it's just for all the viewers, for people that are saying, because especially... You take into account the fact that it has been announced that in the premiere episode, the Doctor will be making an appearance. Capaldi will be there. Why wouldn't he be there? Seriously. Patrick Ness himself tweeted, goes, of course we've got the Doctor in the first episode. What do you think, we're stupid? This is a handover. Literally. So,
well, obviously somebody is stupid, because even if you wanted to not show it right away in the States, why would you wait until Doctor Who airs? Why not you know, have it leading like the 10 weeks right before the premiere, you've got class.
Yeah.
Even like
a marketing buildup.
Yeah.
I need somebody in a position of knowledge to help me understand the reasoning behind this, because we, a bunch of other podcasts, a bunch of other Whovian blogs, we're all scratching our heads on this saying, I don't see the reasoning behind this. No one has a definitive answer yet. They don't even have conjecture as to why this would work. This just flies in the face of logic, and it's killing me. So help, please. Because I know it's going to make things really awkward. We were planning on being down at LI Who and being about four episodes into this to be able to talk it over with other Whovians and cast members and stuff and have a blast with it. And now we have to sit in our hands and say, I'm sorry you didn't see what we've seen, or we haven't seen what you've seen, or it's really, really uncomfortable.
Have they said anything about countries besides the US and the UK? About when they might be getting the show?
I think it's North America that is on the bad end of the stick.
That's what we get for revolting.
So that includes like Space in Canada and some of the other networks. So I don't honestly know. This is just a real puzzle. I don't get it. It's not even a fun puzzle. But the requests are out there to feed us some additional information. We'll keep digging, and I'm sure some things, maybe it's just more conjecture, will come up by the next week. But when we do convene for next week, just so everybody knows, this is actually going to be a little bit of a preview of one of the panels that we'll be doing at upcoming conventions, potentially plural, because it warrants, every time we go to a con and we start talking about Big Finish, people jump out of the woodwork. So what we're doing on this one is actually something that has to do with looking at past Big Finish productions. And I say past, meaning even just as early as last week, you know, when we had Doom Coalition 3 dropped on us, which is freaking brilliant, by the way. But looking at Big Finish productions with emphasis on those stories, the characters that we've been introduced to, or character story arcs that could very feasibly be incorporated into the televised series with tremendous success. So these are instances where what the Big Finish team have done, have put together something or introduced a character or put some element into the Doctor Who into the Doctor Who universe, waiting to be accepted into televised canon, that if they did so, would be great viewing, as well as just the listening that we've been enjoying to date. So keep tuned for that one. If you are Big Finch listeners, and I know we have a number of them, I know a few of you in particular that are extremely outspoken on Big Finch audio, chime in with us, tweet us something, put something on the comments on the Facebook post that we do for this episode, or just, you know, whatever, feedback at gallifreypublicradio.com or what have you. And let us know about what you would consider to be some of the best aspects of what Big Finish has brought to the table that you think would be a tremendous addition to the televised series. It could be something small, like a villain. Well, small, like a villain. or the idea of a particular arc that you think would be a great thing for the Doctor to experience. Any iteration of the Doctor. So that'll be for next week. And then we'll get into our classic rewatch, and then we'll start seeing class on the horizon, because we're traveling to the UK magically. Yep. Right. Anyway. So on this special birthday episode, this has been episode 201 of Gallifrey Public Radio. So until next week, this is Kier saying, Krakatoa!
And this is Haley saying, sausages. Men will become like a string of sausages, all the same.
Is that an innuendo? I don't know. I don't see, kids.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio. Or on Facebook @facebook.com/Gallifrey Public Radio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2016.